I learned this quote about short stories in college, that a short story is a moment in time from which nothing will ever be the same.
Today on Arts and Letters, we'll be talking with writer Amina Gaudier. Her third short story collection, The Loss of All Lost Things, published by Elixir Press, is about reconstituting lives after imaginable and unimaginable losses.
My stories are actually dark, so they're nothing like my personality. I think I've written about 95 stories and only two have happy endings. But even when I'm writing about sadness and mourning, I think there is room for a little bit of levity. So sometimes it's in my descriptions or the characters' reactions.
Amina Gaudier and The Loss of All Lost Things on Arts and Letters. From the studios of KUAR in Little Rock, I'm J. Bradley Minnick, and welcome to Arts and Letters, a program providing opportunities for the celebration of the arts and humanities. Today, we'll be talking to Amina Gaudier, author of three collections, At Risk, winner of the Flannery O'Connor Award for Short Fiction, and Now We Will Be Happy, winner of the Prairie Schooner Book Prize. Her third collection, The Loss of All Lost Things, winner of the Elixir Press Award in Fiction, winner of the Penn Malamud Award for Excellence in the Short Story, and winner of the Phyllis Wheatley Book Award in Fiction, examines the many varieties and variations of loss. The loss of a child, the loss of a parent, the loss of a spouse, the loss of a marriage, the loss of love. Author, academic, award-winning writer, Amina Gaudier, welcome.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
So what's the right mindset to be a literary writer?
For me, it means writing with a sense of honor and nobility. And if I have those things in mind, it means that I won't take shortcuts.
You're kind of, to my mind, a miniaturist. In other words, you look at very small details, but that have larger import.
An ultra-realist.
Ultra-realist, yeah. And I kind of think, particularly with this story that we're going to work through, it is ultra-real, but at the same time, it isn't real.
I think that what makes things real are the details. I'm interested in images that are imbued with weight from the story, not images that have sentimental value that's unearned.
We think of the reader interpreting the image, but you talk about the character interpreting the image a little bit within this story. And I just found that a fascinating flip.
I guess that's just kind of a natural thought process to me, that the image has to work on two levels. It's for the reader, but the character has to interpret it as well. And the reader and the character can have different interpretation.
Loss is a very adult theme. How do you envision loss or losses?
I envision it as something that just continually shapes our lives. I don't mean to imply that children don't suffer losses, but you're vulnerable in a different way than you are when you're an adult and you maybe have been the engineer of your own loss.
You said that you want to know about what happens in between things. So there's the loss, and then there's the aftermath of the loss, but then there's the in-between part, what the person's going through.
Well, I think that for literature, for literary fiction especially, that's where the story really is. I have different backgrounds, different ways of coming into a space, but when we probe those in-between moments or those quiet moments, I think those are the places where we connect.
You're listening to Arts and Letters. We're talking with writer Amina Gaudier about her collection of stories, The Loss of All Lost Things. Let's examine the anatomy of the story, A Brief Pause. Could you set this one up for us? I'm particularly interested, does the wife ever have a name?
She does not have a name in this story.
Yet she is
the main character.
So why was she unnamed?
Most of the time I give my characters names, but when I don't, it is for a reason. So you picked up on that. It's more about the roles that she's playing.
Let's just start from the beginning. It starts with him making breakfast for her.
3 weeks after Roger's mother dies, we're having breakfast in our kitchen. Our table is cluttered with my stacks of admissions files for the college's incoming transfer students. So we pull our chairs up to the kitchen island and eat around large mixing bowls. hunching to keep from being beamed by the unused gleaming copper pots hanging just above our heads. Roger has made this breakfast, though it is my turn, and he has made more than we can possibly eat.
He makes much more food than she ever imagines they can eat.
English muffins, blueberry waffles, scrambled eggs, turkey bacon, and freshly brewed coffee. Much more than the two bowls of cereal and two glasses of orange juice I usually pour.
What's Roger doing there? Is he trying to butter her up?
Very punny indeed. In this particular story, the food is a sign of his generosity. They have this kind of equitable marriage where everything is sort of split 50-50. When it's her turn to make breakfast, she's really stingy about it. It's pretty much a sign that he's willing to do more than his share. And she's willing to do, like, just enough.
Strawberry, red raspberry, blackberry, boysenberry. When Roger asked me to drive with him over to Brooklyn to help clear out his mother's apartment, his face carefully hidden behind the Sunday paper, he pretends innocence when he asks, knowing this is not our arrangement.
She's a kind of other. She feels she has to distance herself from the students who are asking her, why didn't I get into school? Mm-hmm. From her husband who says, will you please go to my deceased mother's house and clean out all her stuff?
And also an other to her old neighborhoods. And so they have this sort of new middle class life, and going back to the mother-in-law's neighborhood or where her husband grew up is also like going back to the hood.
She says he pretends innocence when he asks, knowing this is not our arrangement.
Well, you know, this whole she does this, he does that, and he goes to the mother's house by himself.
How sad. The isolation he must feel.
It's kind of a little bit of like the reverse mother-in-law story.
Right.
You know, where you always have like the guy complaining about all the time that daughter wants to spend with her mother, and the guy saying, well, I'll just stay home and watch football, and you know, you go ahead, go visit your mother.
Right, exactly.
So this is like the flip.
So there's an abundance of food on the kitchen table, but there are also stacks upon stacks of admission files for her to go through.
Behind me on the kitchen table lie the academic lives of prospective students, hopeful and striving. After 1 or 2 years at their current institutions, they have decided that they can and should aim higher. Perfect and nearly perfect GPAs prove they are up for the challenge. Candid essays ask me to rescue them, to extricate them from their current schools, schools that were their safeties, schools they had to attend because they'd gotten waitlisted or sent in their deposits too late. Schools their parents picked because they offered more scholarship money, because they were closer to home. My task is one of discernment.
Why discernment?
Well, for her job in the admissions office. You know, that it's all about being sharp-eyed, eagle-eyed, figuring things out with a laser vision, fine-tooth comb. Specifically in the admissions office, she's just this disembodied anonymous voice that is kind of the voice of failure and doom and rejection. I had a work study job in an admissions office.
So you had seen
back at Stanford.
All the piles.
Roger knows this. So when I do not answer, he puts down the paper and looks at me guiltily, saying,
it's okay if you're busy. You don't have to come.
It is a trick. Roger is a ventriloquist with the truth. Though his mouth says, you don't have to. His eyes say, please, please, please. He closes the passenger door behind me, walks around to his side.
I know I should have done this sooner. I just feel it needs a woman's touch. I won't know what's what. Maybe we'll even find some things we can use. It'll be whatever you say. If you say something goes, it goes. If you say something stays, I get it.
Roger's given his wife carte blanche to do what she needs to do with all his mother stuff. Why does he do that?
Because he would keep it all.
Okay. Lazy, can we
just chill inside.
La, la. Have you ever seen A Jerk? Steve Martin.
Oh, sure.
You know what he's like? All I need is this lamp. And he's like, oh, and this thing. And he keeps taking, you know, like he says he just needs a lamp. And then by the end, he's got like the whole apartment. And that's what Roger, you know, he would be like, oh, I just need, you know, these three things. And then it would be like the whole house. He can't let anything go because everything is valuable to him.
Roger's mother lived her adult life in a rent-controlled two-bedroom apartment in Brownsville on a street of identical housing projects. Side by side, their uniform blondish brick faces, bone-white concrete stoops, and metal-green doors announced the poverty of its inhabitants. His mother lived in the corner building, and all the stoops, except hers, are littered with people out for the day, which feels like summer come early. Young mothers sit on the lowest steps, idly pushing babies in strollers. Boys sit higher up or lean on the railings, playing music. We park in front of a stoop two doors down from his mother's place. A girl sits on the top step, a boy two steps below her. He sits between her knees, arms hooked over her thighs. The people on these stoops knew Roger's mother, and they all called her Miss Mac. Roger's last name is Meg Gooden.
She's there and she's looking at this place and she's not dismissive of it, but she certainly doesn't necessarily like the place or want to be a part of it.
I take the key from him and enter first. Roger carries a handful of heavy-duty trash bags inside. They billow behind him, ghost-like, specters of things long past. Roger's mother was a smoker, though this is not what killed her, and the apartment is thick with the stale odor of smoke. I try not to breathe as I walk through the small, square room to open the living room windows to air out the place. I'll start with the most difficult room first, just to set the tone. Heading to the master bedroom, I say, let's not linger.
This story, I drafted it a long time ago when I was in grad school in 1999 and 2000. And at one point in time, it was called Spectres because I was thinking of the garbage bags and the ghosts and images of this kind of floating thing. But then I revised it and it was called Unraveling. So I had this woman going in and being very brisk about cleaning things up, but this other person wanting to linger and hover and float around. Right. And then the rest of the story came from that. So I see the two of them as being in this ball of yarn, unraveling and being put back together.
It's beautiful. And the mother, she is a knitter. And then these things end up in a garbage bag.
His mother's bedroom closet is crammed with decades of rarely worn clothing. It takes but a glance to see that everything must go. As we bag his mother's clothing, Roger touches each item in passing, making everything take longer. With the exception of our wedding day, where she dressed for the occasion, I'd seen his mother mostly in caftans and muumuus, long or loose-fitting dresses that swallowed her shape. Her closet yields articles of clothing that come as a surprise. Trapeze tops, polyester pants, and dresses with Peter Pan collars, bell sleeves and belted waists, reminiscent of things worn in The Sound of Music, crumble on brown wire hangers beneath the dry cleaner's original plastic. Roger holds the black garbage bag, his face pained as he watches me pile everything in, but he does not protest.
So do you see her as generous?
No.
No.
I see him as just being a little more connected. The food is a sign of generosity, so I wouldn't say that he's made tons of sacrifices for her, but he's not cut off. And she's very cut off.
Wrap your arms around me. I love it whenever.
He has given me carte blanche, and it is too late to take it back. But I can see how much the silence cost him. Eyes glassy with tears, his knuckles swollen from where the blood is rushed. He grips the garbage bag as though it is a lifeline. He holds the bag and lets me drop his mother's things in. If it were left up to him, he'd never be able to decide what to discard and what to keep. He tried to find a way to bring it all home with us, although he knows we don't have the space. This is, after all, why he's brought me along.
Let your love surround me. I can feel your hands throughout my head.
The trick to delivering bad news is to be swift about it, so that the surprise tempers the pain.
She's pretty swift about this moment, too, I guess. She wants in and out. She says she can see how much the silence has cost him.
Yeah.
I feel for her a little bit.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I wrote her.
Right.
I don't, obviously, I have compassion. I'm saying she's not necessarily likable, but I think she's understandable and complicated. And that's what these characters are. Sometimes they do dreadful things, or they cut their own noses off to spite their face.
You know how when you're with someone for a long time, mm-hmm. there's these scripted notions of how we are in the world.
Right.
I was hoping the script would change. I mean, that was my hope here.
Well, I mean, for her, it's all about scripts. I mean, literally in her job, you know, being an admissions officer is narrating scripts. Her background isn't as explicitly stated as his, but they get married when she's 22. So the implication is that they meet in college. And she's been living by scripts to kind of escape that world, you know, to not fall back, to be upwardly mobile. So the script is you do well in school, you go to college, you get married, you move out of the neighborhood, you go to a better life, a better spot, and you put that behind you.
If you divert from the script, maybe bad things could happen.
If you divert, you might end up sliding back. You might end up back where you came from.
He's acting out a kind of pre-established script that I think we can see the end of that story. This is Arts and Letters. We're talking with writer Amina Gaudier about her short story, A Brief Pause.
The bag of clothing nearly full, I feel Roger's eyes on me. He points to a bundled dress on the top of the pile, visible between the plastic. As I gather the opposite edges of the garbage bag to twist them into a knot, Roger darts his hand into the bag and caresses a green polyester dress. This is the first time Roger has been to his mother's apartment since selecting the outfit she was buried in. He knew as well as I that the apartment needed to be cleaned out, but couldn't bring himself to do it. And I hadn't had the heart to force him. I had never been on friendly terms with his mother. And now that she was gone, I felt a measure of remorse for the distance kept between us.
My moment of feeling for her or thinking that she might have become unscripted would have been at the wedding.
It began at our wedding reception, with her coming over to the raised table where Roger and I sat with the bridal party. His mother raised a flute of sparkling cider and toasted us, saying, "Now you're part of the family." Surely, she had meant to be welcoming, but I was young, just 22. And it seemed to me that she just then sucked all of the air from our lives. I'd understood my wedding vows literally, viewing Roger and I as brand new people, believing we were now each other's family. I had envisioned the two of us starting out together on an uncharted path, and before my eyes, that path had become sullied, trampled by the indifferent and muddied footprints of another.
You play with moments of punctuation. So in this case, I heard that as, "Hey, join the family. We love you. Come on in." She heard it as, "Oh my God, this is terrifying." Or, "No."
She would have imagined, okay, everything's brand new now. This is like a blank slate. And now we can throw away the scripts and we can do whatever we want and we can be whoever we want. And then the mother-in-law comes in and is like, "Oh no, now you're joining this family and you just become a part of this."
There are elements of dispossession here, too. Mm-hmm. I mean, being dispossessed of the things that you grew up with that might matter so much to you or have nostalgia for you. In her case, I don't see a lot of nostalgia for much. What are you doing with the concept of dispossession?
Well, in this particular story, it's Roger who has that safety net, even though it's not material, it's just cultural and nostalgia. Like, he can go back to his neighborhood. His mother was still alive. He could go back to her and have his memories alive. But it's something that I'm playing with it in a lot of the stories. there's this idea, again, of wanting to move forward and wanting to acquire and wanting to hold on to things, mm-hmm. but then also realizing that that involves losing things and letting other things slip past.
When we were finally done with the closet, I sent Roger to the kitchen to wrap and box the good china. The only thing that I've identified is worth keeping. The bag is remarkably light. Roger holds it aloft easily.
What's in here?
Just some knitting, I say. Can you bring up the rest of the boxes from the car? After he's gone, I return to his mother's bedroom with two garbage bags to dump out the dresser drawers. The scarred cherrywood bureau is cluttered from framed pictures, a Bible, an address book, a piggy bank, and empty packets of Alka-Seltzer.
For her, there are small, brief moments of illumination, right? She sees a few things, like you said, the jewelry box, mm-hmm. that she has a bit of an epiphany with.
Roger's mother never threw anything away. Scissors, a small sewing kit, a pack of sewing needles, pennies, dried out pins, black bobby pins, expired coupons, yellowed handkerchiefs, nylon balls of knotted knee highs, and a black lacquer jewelry box.
Right. Well, the music that comes, you know, tinkling out evokes a sort of nostalgic moment, but they don't take the jewelry box.
Or she, pictures of him before she knew him, but
right.
she had never seen him.
And she doesn't take those either. She's like,
know.
Nope, that's not the guy I married. Those can stay here. She only wants the things that have like monetary value, the china. So all this stuff that has sentimental value, she leaves behind.
Most of the pictures are of Roger before I ever knew him.
Wandering aimlessly, singing low.
I pick up each one and search for his face beneath the layers of dust. It is easy to see that he's altogether a different man now. These are not my mother's things. They do not move me. On the stoop below, Roger stands with the black garbage bag in his hand, clenching its neck, strangling the bag indifferently. His face tilted upwards. His stance is fixed, as if looking at something in the distance. There are only four steps separating him from the end of the stoop, yet he does not dump the garbage. Between the stoops, squat concrete sheds with blue metal doors provide a discreet method of disposal. Roger had played atop these sheds as a young boy. He'd shown me the way the boys would get a running start and leap onto the sheds, the smaller boys having to hoist. The sheds could be home in a game of tag or a base in a game of stickball, anything a poor boy could imagine. If he would only walk down the remaining four steps, he'd be able to go to those sheds and dump the bag he clutches with such a death grip and be done with it for once and for all.
Wandering aimlessly, singing low.
My sense is that the wife believes that everything's going to be okay. My sense is that Roger is not okay and
right.
things are not going to be okay. And the one thing the wife wanted in some ways would be Roger for herself, or at least Roger's life with her for herself. Now the impediment to that is gone, but to me it seems that their relationship is not going to fare well.
I do believe that there are repercussions down the line. You know, I forgot who said it, but I learned this quote about short stories in college, that a short story is a moment in time from which nothing will ever be the same. All I can say is what's happening in this moment is shaping future moments to come. That's one of the great things about short stories. Like, only the moment is definitive. You can revisit the characters 6 months later and they can be in a completely different place.
Two stoops down from Roger, the girl takes a wide-tooth comb and parts her boyfriend's thick, unruly hair. Turning his head to the side, she combs out a section just along his ear and begins to braid his hair in cornrows. Nimbly, she braids his hair, evoking order out of chaos. The metal railing burns beneath my hand. I stop midway down the stoop and come to Roger's side. Roger continues to stare. When I look toward the sun to see what he sees, I don't see anything.
I can't do it.
His hand shakes from holding the neck of the bag so tightly. Roger leans against me, his coarse hair scratching through the thin fabric of my blouse. His face turned from me as he cries softly, politely, as not to disturb.
She's looking at him and she sees him almost wanting to strangle that garbage bag but can't let go of it. What's the cost?
To her or to him?
Both.
For him, the cost is a painful one, because after they leave this time, that's it. You know, they'll turn in the lease and that apartment will be over, and it will be obviously no more seeing your mother, but also no more returning to where you're from and then leaving it behind. So literally, finally, he's going to be the new person that she thought they were going to be when they were married. You know, so there's going to be a cost to him, like a kind of rendering of the self. And for her, what I've always imagined is that afterwards, that she's being stoic, but that afterwards, that this might be a moment that you continue to regret.
Want some help? I ask at a loss. There is no script for this moment between us. Roger looks up, eyes me warily, as if this is some sort of a trick. We both know this is not something that I can do for him. We both know I have done all I can.
No. Thanks.
I cup his shoulder, rub my hand lightly up and down his arm. The bag falls open, and it is hard to know whether Roger has given up and let it go, or if it has merely slipped his grasp. Unfinished sweaters, shawls, and mittens spill onto the sidewalk like brightly colored innards, unraveling as they fall. We do not pick them up. If I listen closely, I can hear the rejected applicants when they cry. During that pause, while they are waiting for me to undo what I've done, I can hear them pull themselves together. When they thank me before hanging up, their voices, tremulous and confused, give it away. They clear their throats, struggling to make themselves seem unaffected. But if you listen, you can hear how hard it is to let go.
Broadcast from the studios of KUAR in Little Rock, you've been listening to Arts and Letters. Thanks for joining us. To check out past episodes, go to artsandlettersradio.org. Leave us a comment there and let us know what you've thought about the program. Thank you to musicians and songwriters, Cami Renee.
Lazy, I don't wanna go anywhere.
Off the Cuff. And Tim Anthony. A special thanks to Jeff Condren for facilitating this interview. Thank you to actors Patrice Phillips and Clyde Slater III for lending your voices to this project. Thank you to the superlative production of Adam Simon of Simon Sound. Thank you to Sticky's Rock and Roll Chicken Shack for keeping music alive and well in Arkansas. Thank you to the Four Points by Sheridan, Little Rock Midtown, for providing accommodations to guests on Arts and Letters. Generous funding for this episode was provided by the Arkansas Humanities Council and the National Endowment for the Humanities. Thank you to Amina Godier for writing fictional stories about true things and allowing us a brief pause. For Arts and Letters, I'm J. Bradley Minnick. Let's heed the words of Stanley Elkin. Writing is a kind of whittling, a kind of honing to the bone, until you finally get whatever the hell it is you're looking for. It's an exercise in sculpture, chipping away at the rock until you find the nose.